I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about great reads. It's the book show. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Recommendations for great reads coming your way. It's a call-in. Let us know what you liked. And give the gift of a good story or interesting information to other Faith Middleton Show listeners. 203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. Book clubs, what are you reading? Please let us know. We like books in any category. If you prefer, tell us on Facebook. Search the Faith Middleton Show or tweet us at FaithWNPR. In other words, there is no escaping. My book buddies are here. Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut, co-editor of the book, The Book That Changed My Life. Lee Jacobus, editor of the college textbook, A World of Ideas, and a new short story collection called Hawaiian Tales, which is now out in paperback. Yes. Yeah. And we wanted to say a quick hello to Rose Quiello, who's on a short leave of absence from us. We're not going to let her stay away for too long. Okay, Roxanne, what do you have?
I have a memoir by Penelope Lively. And when it comes around next time, I'll talk about one of her books. This is her memoir. It's called Dancing Fish, and I don't know how to pronounce the second word, Ammonites, A-M-O-N-I-T-E-S, a memoir. So this is not a memoir in the sense that it's done chronologically. So she has a section on old age. She has a section on reading and writing. And she has a section on life and times. And what she does, this feels extremely conversational, as does another book I'm reading. So I'm not sure if that's sort of a mood I'm in. And her section on old age makes you feel not sad about old age, but appreciative and celebratory. And one of the things that she does is she talks about, you know, she's always written fiction or predominantly fiction. And she says, you know, when you write fiction, you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you kind of wrap it up. And, you know, real life's not that way, right? It has a chaoticness to it. And that could feel sad and unmanageable and uncontrollable. But somehow when you read this, or when I read it, I thought, I just want to stay with this book. I want to hear what this woman has to say. It was the ultimate of...
That's a good quality.
You know, that you read to know how to live your life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read this and I thought, I like this lady. So it's Penelope Lively, Dancing Fish in, we'll say, Ammonites.
Dancing Fish and Ammonites. Okay. Nancy, Faith Middleton and the gang, welcome to the book show. Thanks for calling 203-776-9677. Go ahead, Nancy.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I just read a book recommended by one of the adjunct teachers that I work for. And it was such a surprise. I never heard of this author. His name is J. Robert Lennon. And the book is called The Funnies.
The Funnies?
And the book is kind of about, it kind of mirrors that The Funnies, the family circle. But it's kind of about a dysfunctional family, and the man who draws the funnies and tells the story. It's a very, very nice book, and it reminds me kind of Pat Conroy's writing.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I like him a lot, Pat Conroy. Okay, The Funnies. Thank you so much.
Love it.
Oh, that sounds good. Thanks. Thanks, Nancy.
Okay,
call again anytime. All right, Lee Jacobus.
Well, I just reread a book that absolutely put me into hysterics of laughter about 40 years ago when it first came out. It's Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim. It's certainly the funniest of all academic novels. Lucky Jim is Jim Dixon, who ends up in a British small provincial college, which he absolutely finds is stultifying and boring beyond all words. And the people who are superior to him are all extremely pretentious Englishmen who do things like sing madrigals and play their recorders and do all the stuff that he just finds absolutely abhorrent. And so he goes and he spends spends the night at his boss's house, at the dean's house, and he falls asleep with a cigarette in his hand. He's been dead drunk, burns holes in the duvet on top of the bed and on the coverlet beneath it. And then he wakes up and he says, "Oh my God, what have I done?" And he takes out some scissors and he cuts all the burned part around the holes so that they would look neater, thinking this would solve the problem. And I tell you, when I first read this, and this time too, I just laughed like mad. But as a young person coming across this for the first time, I thought I would absolutely die of laughter. And he goes on with lots of other wonderful things like this. He eventually discovers himself to be a person of deep feeling, and he starts off. You think he's awful. You think he's just simply thoughtless and irreverent and essentially mean and unhappy. But he turns out to be an extraordinarily person who redeems himself by saving a woman who was going to marry into this very family that he hated. He takes her away at the end of the book. It's just wonderful. This is often called the funniest comic novel of the 20th century.
And really? That's quite a thing to say.
Well, this is said many times. It also was a classics book club of the New York Review of Books just in October. And we did it at R.J. Julia's in our classics book club, not knowing that they were doing it. So it's Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis, one of the funniest of all possible academic novels.
As I get to the book I want to talk about, which is from a New Yorker magazine cartoonist, I wanted to mention that Arianna Huffington, who's founder of the Huffington Post, has a new book called Thrive about defining success, and she is guest speaker at a benefit and book signing in New Haven for Read to Grow. It's a luncheon, and our Roxanne Cody is chair of its board. Read to Grow, citing the heavy price we pay for low literacy, promotes language learning and literacy for children starting at birth and supporting parents as their baby's first teachers. That's quite a thought, that parents are babies' first teachers. We know that, but those words are so powerful to me. So books through this program are given out at many of the state's hospitals. And for information on the Read to Grow Luncheon with Arianna Huffington, it is Tuesday, April 15th. Go online to readtogrow.org. That's readtogrow.org. Okay, the book I want to talk about is How About Never? Is Never Good for You? One of the best lines ever in a cartoon, I think. And it is My Life in Cartoons. Bob Mankoff, who is one of the best cartoonists at The New Yorker and someone we intend shortly to have on this show for a call-in show. And I don't know about you, but I like a million other people, yeah, I have a secret desire to be a New Yorker cartoonist and have gone so far through the years as I even have an envelope full of the cartoons that I just couldn't draw. That was my problem. I couldn't illustrate anything.
You should partner up with an illustrator.
Maybe. I guess I never. Can you do that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I'll do that. Well, maybe you'd want to judge the quality of these before you make that suggestion. Anyway, so what is so great about Bob Mankoff? First of all, he's hilarious. And here, listen to the flap copy on this book. You know, you open it, it's at the bookstore, the library. You open it up and you think, "All right, should I get this?" And there's a little headline on the inside, and it says, "A hilarious memoir in cartoons by the longtime cartoon editor of The New Yorker." And then the copy begins. "Hi, this is me, Bob Mankoff, the above-mentioned longtime editor, breaking all sorts of protocol by writing the flap copy myself." Anyway, most of it. The PR people at Henry Holt insisted on putting the word hilarious in the headline. And when I suggested substituting the endearingly self-effacing, quote, "mildly humorous" in some spots, the flacks in charge of the flap flipped out. But after I acceded on that one, they said, "Fine, do it your own way. We have other flaps to flack." But enough about them. This is, after all, my memoir, and even though you can't spell memoir without M-E, I promise you this isn't just another Much Ado About Me memoir. For one thing, there's the New Yorker magazine, which has published approximately 78,000 cartoons since its founding.
Wow.
Isn't that something? Wow. And on he goes. Very, very clever. But so generously, what he did was not just talk about his own work, of course, but to talk and feature the work of his colleagues. And so, Roxanne, let's chat for a minute about this, because I know you love this book, too.
So here's the thing. On my desk is the cartoon that the guy's on the phone. He said, how's never? Does never work for you? I love that. Because don't you want to sometimes say that?
Oh, when that cartoon came out, it changed culture, I think. Everybody said it.
Yes.
Just every chance they got. Okay, so one of my favorite cartoons that he features in this book is from Sam Gross, who's a New Yorker cartoonist. And so there's a picture of a man holding the leash of a dog, and he's got a cup in his hand and glasses on, and he's wearing a sign. He's blind, obviously, and he says, I am blind and my dog is dead. And the dog is just like sprawled out on the sidewalk.
Why do we find that funny?
Dark humor.
It's black so, humor. So funny. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's just so funny. Who would do that as a cartoon? But it's so hilarious. It's like laughing at a funeral. You just cannot laugh.
I know.
Okay, so how about Never is Never Good for You, My Life in Cartoons by Bob Mankoff, and he'll be on the show shortly, and I cannot recommend this more highly. Roxanne, where's our number? 203-776-WNPR. If you have a book that you have liked, book clubs, we'd like to hear from you.
So I promised I'd talk about a book of Penelope Lively's, and one of my favorites is a book called The Photograph. And this older professorial type guy's wife, who was much younger, somewhat younger than him, died suddenly. And he's going through all her clothes and papers, and he comes across an envelope that says, do not open, confidential. So, of course, she opens it. And it's a picture of his wife holding the hand of a man, and it's a picture from the back. And he doesn't know who the man is, but there's something incredibly intimate about the way they're holding hands. And the rest of the book is about trying to understand whether he knew his wife or not, or what this was. Was it something, had she had an affair? Did she have another life going on? And it was a remarkable analysis of how you can be in a relationship that is good and connected and not necessarily know the other person.
Uh-huh. Ooh.
And it has a little bit of the quality of a mystery, but it's really about the exploration of what relationships are like. It's just fantastic.
This is an airplane read. This is a beach read. This is great. I would run and get this for the summer.
It's just great. It's just wonderful. It's called The Photograph by Penelope Lively.
Okay. And we have lots more coming your way. Stacks and stacks of books all over the room to recommend to you. And we'd love to hear from you. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more of The Book Show. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can find a list of books. You can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and more. Click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. Okay, this is The Book Show. We invite you to tell us about a book that you have liked in any category. Book clubs, we want to hear from you, too. We'd love to know what our book clubs are doing at individual readers. We want you. This is the way that we find, this is really how word about books gets spread. word of mouth. And so that's the role of this show and has been for so many years, I mean, decades. So jump right in and be part of it, 203-776-9677. Don't feel pressure. You don't have to do some big analysis. You just have to tell us the name of the book, if the author, if you can think of it, and maybe a little something that you liked about the book. And believe me, I hear all over the place from people that they are writing things down, running to the website, trying to find the lists of things. So I wanted to mention that I love this book. Perhaps you heard the show we recently did with Leah Hager Cohen. The book is I Don't Know. It is a book in praise of admitting ignorance, except when you shouldn't. She is a novelist, and it is pretty unusual for her to do something like this. And yet she did, and it is written with the grace of a very good novelist. And so that recommends it right away. But also, she is so smart about what she chooses as examples of, you know, why we catch ourselves. I certainly have done this in my life, pretended that I knew something I didn't know because I was embarrassed or I was ashamed. And so she looks at that, and we all know that that's some sense of shame. And we also know that people sometimes in business meetings don't want to admit they don't know something because it's a competitive atmosphere. But she goes through all these things in life, all these great books, these philosophers who've had things to say about this topic, and weaves it all together. It is really good. Mm. I Don't Know is the name of the book. Leah Hager, H-A-G-E-R, Cohen, in praise of admitting ignorance, except when you shouldn't. Brian, Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Hi. I read a lot of biographies. I just read a couple of autobiographies in the last couple months. They're both written by Canadian singers. One is Anne Murray and one is Paul Anka. Anka's just came out, like, say, probably last year, and Anne Murray's is about 4 years old.
So do you tend to read these biographies of singers?
It could be singers,
actors,
it could be a politician, a ball player, anyone that I find one that strikes my fancy.
You know, my aunt would do this. That is pretty much what she existed on in terms of her reading, and it added so much to her life, reading these life stories. What do you think it adds to your life?
I don't see. I'm always interested in figuring out how life works. I think the biggest thing you have to figure out in life is people, how you deal with people. And that ends up being a big part of biographies because you see what went wrong. Let's say it was dealing with someone they were working for, mm-hmm. neighbor, whatever it was, and that ends up being kind of a turning point in their life. You know what I mean?
So, yeah. And yet you're also driven by curiosity since you knew the work of the person. What's
right,
the life
right.
like behind all that? That's
right,
great.
Yeah.
I am so glad you called. Thank you so much. Please call anytime.
Sure. Thank
All right. You. You're welcome. Lee Jacobus.
Well, talk about word of mouth. I want to spread by word of mouth the news that one of the very finest writers alive today is the British novelist Jane Gardam. She is so good, she just knocks my socks off. She is the author of a very popular trilogy that's really gotten into the wind just recently. It's the Old Filth Trilogy. Filth is an acronym for Failed in London, Try Hong Kong. And the three novels are Old Filth, Man in the Wooden Hat, and Last Friends. I'm not going to talk about those books because I've actually mentioned them before, but I want you to know they're out there. It is a brilliant thing. She happens to have another book that I just read that is terrifically comic and terrifically strange. It's called Queen of the Tambourine. It's by Jane Gardam.
Okay, so but the book you're recommending is?
Is The Queen of the Tambourine, yes.
The Queen of the Tambourine.
Right.
Now, okay.
I recommend the Old Filth Trilogy, too. But
I see. Okay, I thought that's the one you were going for. Okay,
No, I say that I'm holding that on ice. We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
But The Queen of the Tambourine is a wonderfully comic novel. It's about a woman, or let's say about a neighbor of a woman who leaves everything behind, her husband, her family, everything, and she just goes around the world, and she leaves addresses in Jakarta and other parts of the strange world, weird places, and no one can reach her except by mail. Well, her neighbor, Eliza Peabody, decides that she'll talk to her and say, look, don't worry about your husband. He isn't attracted to women, because I know that, because if he were attracted to women, he would be attracted to me, because I am so, you know, I'm really very beautiful and very attractive. This isn't conceit, she said. This is a quote. This isn't conceit. This is a fact. So don't worry about your husband. Well, things go on, and she sends her various messages, and every message has an implied insult. You know how some people try to say nice things to you, and they're really underneath the surface, they're really a deep insult?
Yeah,
well, that's what happens.
We call that passive aggressive.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is passive aggressive. And what happens is that The Queen of the Tambourine is a book of letters, where every letter is filled with that kind of passive aggressive nonsense, at one point, the Joan who has left town sends Eliza a gift, and it's a gift of earrings that look like tambourines, and that's why Eliza eventually becomes known as the Queen of the Tambourines, and people call it it's a hilarious novel, and it's just wonderful, because if you've ever had a neighbor who you know has been a problem, this is the book to read. It's Jane Gardam, G-A-R-D-A-M, British novelist, Queen of the Tambourine, and she's brilliant.
Lee, I'm just remembering that you have mentioned her in the past, but I'm sitting here thinking, who is that? I don't know about her. I know Roxanne, you do know her, so I really want to read her.
Yeah,
she is really smart.
Yeah,
she is really smart. And, you know, the publisher who publishes her is Europa Press. And what they've done is looked all around the world for the books that they think are the best to translate into English. And Mike Reynolds, who's the managing editor, they've just done a great job. And bringing Jane to the United States, I think, is one.
Yeah. Well, she's just wonderful.
Roxanne Cody.
So this is a book called Why I Read, The Serious Pleasure of Books by Wendy Lesser. And I've talked about her years ago. She wrote a book about rereading. She's the essayist. She's the founder of Three Penny Review. And this book articulates why we all read. And what she then does, so she has a little prologue about why she reads and talks about the way a great book takes you out of yourself, but then also makes you more self-aware of yourself, you know, that kind of seeming dichotomy. And then she divides the book up into chapters where she talks about all the different books she's read and which ones she thinks do characters so interestingly, or plot or mystery. She covers science fiction. She covers the classics.
And do you have to have read the books too?
Absolutely not. Now, I think that's, you know, what books like this do for me is, A, they're a pleasure in and of themselves, but they also make you think about books. I never did read that, and I don't need to. Or I never read it, and I can't wait. There's just something fantastic about the way she writes. And she doesn't sound like an academic at all, which you might think she would. She sounds totally accessible. So it's called Why I Read, The Serious Pleasure of Books.
Why I Read, 203-776-9677 here on The Book Show. Tell us about a book that you have liked. Here is one. David Menashe was a high school English teacher, and he developed stage 4 brain cancer. And so on Christmas Eve 2012, he decides that he's going to go visit his former students. This is real. He's going to go visit his former students to see if he's made a difference in any of their lives before it's too late. So his book is called The Priority List. And so the title of this memoir it's inspired by one of his favorite classroom lessons, The Priority List, which in his classes used to consist of these 10 words: wealth, respect, love, strength, and education. And he used to ask these students to rank these in order of importance, and then they would have a big discussion about this. So he goes off, and he thinks to himself, cancer has taken my past, and it's going to take my future, and I'm not going to let it steal this moment I'm in. So he goes off on this journey, and this book is a story of the exchanges that he has with these young people. And it is so good. It is really good.
I want to leave and go read that now.
Yeah, it really is. You know, so The Priority List by David Menashe, M-E-N-A-S-C-H-E. Roman Faith Middleton, welcome to the show. I'm with Roxanne Cody and Lee Jacobus, as you know. Go ahead.
Thanks, yeah. I just read a book called Abundance by Peter Diamandis, the nonfiction. But it's about the future and how technology and exponential technology specifically will sort of save the future and save humanity.
Oh, listen, I was just with the former president of Random House for dinner, and this is the book at the table that they were all raving about. You know, we were talking about books that we have loved, and that they just couldn't speak more highly about abundance, abundance, abundance. So
yeah,
you're in great company. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Bye bye. Whose turn is it?
I'll go.
All right, Roxanne Cody.
So this has a little bit of a now we're dropping books.
That's okay.
A little bit of a background. So I think I've mentioned on the show that I moved. And in moving, I had thousands and thousands of books in my house on three floors, and I had to decide what books to take or not. And mostly they were logical. But there was this book that I moved, and I don't know why I moved it. I just had no idea why I moved it, and it's called Touching Quiet, Reflections in Solitude by Mindy Wiesel. So I happened to pick it up last week. And I'm in the process of thinking about writing a book about my parents, who were both Holocaust survivors. And I open the book, and she is the daughter of Auschwitz survivors, and her parents were in the bakery business, as were mine. And writes this book, she's a painter, writes this book about deciding at the age that I'm about now to go away for a month and find out what it's like to be quiet, since she spent her entire life at the direction of her family, of having a life of abundance, you might say, or filled with everything, but mostly noise and doing too much, and took this, and it was magical to me. It was one reaffirming about why, without being anti-technology, you have to have books there. They have to be. Why I moved this book.
So now, does she talk in her book about what it is like to go through the quiet period? Does she try
yes.
to describe
she
it?
She keeps a journal.
Uh-huh.
This
and
actually a journal.
And it's beyond the amazing coincidence of the parallel, but it's interesting the way she does it.
It's fascinating because she talks about being homesick. You know, it teaches you, it's a month, so it teaches you another rhythm. She's shocked at how much she sleeps because she prides herself on not sleeping that much. She is learning about how she would do a rhythm of being social and being private, but mostly, I mean, I love this term, touching quiet. And, you know, it was striking to me because it seems like in real life she sounds similar to me, whether I have no idea whether she is, although I intend to write to her. I love her art, which is very abstract and very full of emotion, and the contrast with listening to her, I'll say, talk about what it was like to sort of retreat and find what I don't think most of us get to find, which is your natural rhythm and your natural you.
Who was it? What was the name of the writer who used to do it? Mae Sarton. Remember
yes.
a million years ago?
Yes.
Every book was about going off and being alone and every minute.
Yeah.
And you know. I wasn't quite so captivated by those books as others were. You know, others were. I found some of that tedious after a while. And the reason I was quizzing you is to say, because it's hard to pull off. There's something quite beautiful about Thoreau and, you know, people who do this, provided there's this.
Well, the one who I thought did it the best that I had read, and I still would hold that up as the pinnacle, which is 50 Days of Solitude by Doris Gumbach, Gumbach. That was lyrical and beautiful and poignant. I mean, that is an astonishing book. This is a little bit more diary-like, journal-like, which worked for me for this minute. But okay. I would say the big smart book for me on this subject would be 50 Days of Solitude. It was the timing, the background, the notion of this that was perfect for this minute.
Mm. Wonderful.
Yeah.
See, that is the thing. It's the gift of a book. And I love those moments, that sort of serendipitous thing, with these moments where you're on vacation. I talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
And you've run out of things to read. You pull something off a shelf. You don't even know what it is. And it has some huge impact on you.
I mean, I open this thing and I was stunned.
Yeah. And sounds like is helping to give you the confidence to go forward, or the energy anyway.
Or
which
or
is ironic, a book about
not.
Quiet.
Get it rocks, this is a message. No.
Open a bakery instead. Mary, Faith Middleton and the gang, welcome to the book show.
Oh, hi, Faith. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a great fan of the show.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to share with you all a newly released memoir called To Dance in the Rain, A Mother and Daughter's Journey of Hope and Healing. The author is actually Claire Keating, my sister, and she shares with everyone when the unthinkable happened to her and her family back in 2002. Her child suffered a catastrophic complications after surgery, and she gives a very telling memoir surrounding the events, stories within the story. She shares the years that she and the family kept vigil, and it's really something that I think that anyone facing a life-altering illness or injury of a loved one would really find very encouraging and inspiring. Mm. So I wanted to share that with you.
Would you do me a favor and repeat the title and the author's name?
Yes, To Dance in the Rain, A Mother and Daughter's Journey of Hope and Healing. And the author is Claire Keating, K-E-A-T-I-N-G, and it's published by Seton Press, C-E-I-T-I-N-N Press.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad you called. 203-776-9677 here on The Book Show. We'll take a quick break, and then Lee's got something to recommend. Tweet us at FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening. And to our talented team, Senior Producer Lori Mack and Producer Jonathan McNichol. This is The Book Show. It is a call-in. We invite you to tell us about a book that you have liked. 203 individuals or book club members. 203-776-WNPR. Aloise, Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello, Faith, and all of your guests. We have a book stack at the library here, and for 25 cents you can buy a hard copy or soft. I picked up a book called Hidden Wives by Claire Avery, and it's dedicated to all victims of polygamy. It is fiction, very well written. I'm just getting into it, and it is wonderful.
Now, is that Wives with a W?
Correct.
Hidden Wives. Okay. Oh, wow. So who wrote this and why? Was this someone?
Claire Avery, and apparently the names that they're using are pseudonyms. They're actually two sisters who have gotten together and made up this name. Huh. And it's based on truth, but it's fiction. And it's just delightful.
And is this an old one or?
No, actually it was published. I looked at it, published in 2010.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, right, 2010.
Aloise, you obviously work at a library. Which one are you at?
No, I don't work at a library. But
you're a patron. I see.
East Hampton, Connecticut.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Glad to talk to you. Now. Bye-bye. Call anytime. Lee Jacobus.
Well, you know, I like Tony Hillerman and his mysteries. I just can't get enough of them somehow or other. I've got a stack still that I'm going to plow through slowly. But this one is called Talking God. The Navajo word is Yebichai, which is a god that in this case happens to be in the Smithsonian Institution. It's obviously a sculpture, and it's obviously a religious object. But this novel starts off incredibly strangely. A lawyer at the Smithsonian gets a package with two human skeletons in the package. They gets a note with it explaining that these are her ancestors dug up from a New England graveyard.
Could you just stop right there? Because I just want to say that's irresistible.
It is.
I mean, if you had to sit down, you sit down and you try and think of ways to begin a mystery. Every person. And that is just irresistible.
It just blows your mind. You just say, what? How can this possibly be? And of course, you can imagine how this lawyer felt when she's getting the bones of her ancestors. And the note says, look, if you will return the bones of my ancestors, then we'll put these back in the grave. There's going to be an exchange. It's a wonderful book. Of course, it's filled with mystery. Jim Chee and Lieutenant Leaphorn are here, his great Navajo heroes. And Jim Chee is spending time in Washington, D.C. because his girlfriend, a lawyer, also is there. It's just a wonderful
Hillerman,
book.
So Hillerman, I haven't read Hillerman, although we are mystery buddies.
Yeah, right.
I haven't read Hillerman. So he has these people who keep coming back.
Oh, yes. Oh, you must read Hillerman. Oh my goodness gracious! They're just you can't get enough of them. They're just irresistible. Jim Chee is marvelous. He's thoughtful. He's a smart guy. Lieutenant Leaphorn is, of course, the strong, silent type who pulls rank all the time. And the two of them are often at odds with each other, but they always solve the mystery by one means or another. They're brilliant, and of course, the portraits of people on the Navajo reservations are just wonderful, and the life of the reservation is fascinating. A lot of mayhem out there, apparently, given these mysteries. But you know, it's the same kind of mayhem you get anywhere. But it's just extraordinary the way he works things out. This one is called Talking God, and it's by Tony Hillerman. Tony, unfortunately, has died in the last few years, but he has a legacy of dozens of books that are just wonderful to read.
Ron, Faith Middleton and the gang, welcome to the book show.
Thank you. How are you doing?
We're great. How about you?
Great. I just finished reading an awesome book. It's a nonfiction book called Dry Storeroom Number One. And it's a history of the Natural History Museum in London by Richard Forty. And this book is awesome. It's not only is it just, you know, talks about how the museum has evolved over the years, but it has these great descriptions of all the people, all the denizens of the museum that have worked there since 1875 or something. So these people are so so intense and so into their work that they have some incredibly interesting behaviors they exhibit at the museum, which is really funny.
So Dry Storeroom Number One.
Yes. Yep. And I would just say that the other thing about this book is that there's a lot of science in it that's, across all the natural history disciplines. That's really interesting. So he's a paleontologist, so he keeps it interesting that way, too.
Oh, so you're learning and having a great time in the process.
Yep.
Thank you so much. Glad you called.
You.
Okay,
yep.
Bye-bye. There has been a lot of attention, a lot of discussion about this book, The Splendid Things We Planned. It's a family portrait. So we have a biographer that many people know, Blake Bailey. He is a National Book Critics Circle Award winner, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He did The Lives of John Cheever, Richard Yates, most recently Charles Jackson. So he decides, and the publishers are interested, I can understand why, to turn his biographer's eye on himself and his own family. So I've been reading review after review about this book. People seem to like this so much. And so I'm letting you know that this is out. It is the story about the engulfing effect that family members have on one another's lives. In this case, we're talking about Blake Bailey's brother, who is his brother Scott, who was a bit of a wild man. and just, you know, got into drugs, pulled Blake Bailey into all this. Just charismatic brother, and he grows up to, you know, pursue this single-minded path of self-destruction. And Blake, as a sibling, measures himself against this brother all the time. So it's a look at those intimate dynamics in a family. And in all the reviews, you see the picture of the two of them sitting there, two handsome guys.
Yeah, I've read those reviews too. In fact, I've read a number of his books. He's and I've even talked to him. He's a remarkable guy. And his book on Richard Yates is absolutely a masterpiece. It's a heartbreaking book. It's one I really recommend to anyone who thinks that he or she may want to be a writer one day.
Yeah. Okay. So great, Roxanne Cody. What do you have?
So every once in a while, I like to bring a children's book because. Mm-hmm. They make me smile. And this book is called Peggy. And the subtitle is A Brave Chicken on a Big Adventure. So Peggy is a chicken and lives in a house, never really goes anywhere, likes her little chicken house quite well. And then ends up, you know, she plays in the yard. She watches her pigeons. She's got sunflowers. And then all of a sudden she flew off and she ended up in a city. And she did pretty well in the city. You know, she went to go see department store windows and she met lots of people. And, you know, she was having a really good time and there were lots of illustrations. But she realized she really wanted to go home. And she tried to talk to people, but they didn't really understand her, right? She's a chicken. So she was becoming a little sad about this and wondering how she was going to get home after this great visit in New York. And then she ran into some pigeons, and she realized that the pigeons might know how to get her home. And, in fact, they lead her back home. And so she got to have the adventure. That she became friends with the pigeons. She hadn't been friends with them before. They were just like pigeons.
So, your own pigeon to me?
And happily ever after.
You know, you're making me, that is so funny. You're making me think about, there's a run on chicken books, by the way.
Is it really?
Well,
you know,
chickens are the in thing to raise.
But
now,
also,
right?
No, I mean chickens for in kids' stories. We've gotten so many of them lately.
Oh, that's funny.
It's really interesting. You know what I've been thinking about lately? And now you're making me think of it again. How children's book writers use every kind of animal that they can think of to tell the story of human experience. And it can be hilarious because there's something about the chicken, this really truly magnificent bird, that is funny. I don't know why, but it is. And so, you know, you can do a lot.
I was just charmed. Stephanie, who works at the
store, I'm charmed.
Always tries to, like, show me the best of the best. And she brought this to me, you know, right before I came to the show. She said, Rox, it's time for you to do a kid's book. And she has pitch-perfect judgment about kids' books, Stephanie. And I said, you're right. It just made me smile.
So how far do you think these children's books can go in terms of darkness and have it be okay for the kids? You know, the Grimm's fairy tales,
yeah, that's
obviously.
That's what I was thinking of immediately. You know, I mean, there's no limits, apparently.
Grimm doesn't begin to describe it. So although, you know, some say, well, I mean, I've heard psychiatrists talk about what this has taught children as they're growing up. I've heard others say that this is really kind of damaging and weird. What do you think?
My take is the happy ending. My take is if it wraps up with a happy ending, then it's okay. What actually was sort of pathetically, one of the women who had worked at the store like over 20 years ago used to give a book as a gift to me for Edward on Edward's birthday, my son Edward. And he was about five, and I'm reading this book, and I hadn't looked at it before, and I'm reading it to Edward, and I realize it's about a kid who's kidnapped, and at the end of the book, he's never found.
See,
this like, what's with that?
Yeah,
that's not a good book. Just
who published that book? And how did it do?
Really,
I have come across a few of these, and that's why I'm asking, because I think, well, maybe I'm being too sensitive about this, but they were really upsetting to me.
Well, I think I also think it's about age. We once had a man, I wish I could remember his name, from the Yale Child Study Center, right after 9/11, about how do you deal with, like, dark events with your kids and how do you talk about these things? And, you know, obviously as they get older, what I consider it a great opportunity to do is have a conversation. So the parent reads it and the 11 or 12 or 13-year-old reads it, and it's an opportunity for conversation. But when they're little, I don't think that's necessary. That's my own personal feeling. Yeah. They don't need dark at night at 5 years old. They don't need, like, a ghost who comes out and stays.
Lee, well, how did you – here you are, a literature professor. How did you think of it when your kids were growing up?
Well, that's good. That's a good question. I avoided those kinds of stories. I didn't read the fairy tales very much. We read some Chinese long Chinese novels, actually. It sounds a little weird. But they still – there was the Monkey King thing that they still talk about it. They really loved it, you know. Yeah.
And they talk about it in what terms? Well, endearment?
Yes, they liked the idea that we would all sit around the living room and read that book, and that was really one of the things. But, you know – when you talk about certain ages, my uncle gave me, this is about 1945 or so, or no, but 1940, it had to be 1947, sorry, 42, I was seven. He gave me a Charlie McCarthy doll, the whole full-size Charlie McCarthy, you know,
puppet,
right. And I put it underneath my bed when I went to bed to sleep that night, the first night I got it. And I woke up in the middle of the night absolutely screaming, thinking that it was real and it was alive and that it was evil. I mean, I don't know how I got that feeling, but when I think about that, and you're talking about the dark humor, I was about to say, oh yeah, kids really love dark humor. Then I thought of that, about that. I was scared to death.
Although, look at all the great things from Maurice Sendak. I mean, it's a very interesting area. So maybe we'll I think we should do a show on this.
Well, you know, Maurice Sendak's book, I think, is a great way to think about the conversation in a broader way, because you can read that book in lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to have, like, ask first grade teachers or second grade teachers what have they read that with their kids, and what's – or a librarian. You could ask Lynn Johnson or somebody and see what their take is on kids' reaction to that.
Mm. Yeah. Because
I think we read Maurice Sendak and I made it silly.
Huh,
right. I didn't go to the dark place.
Yeah, well, because you could – you it left room for you to figure
absolutely.
It out.
Absolutely, and it had those incredible illustrations. You could do anything with them.
I have certainly been to animated movies, Disney movies, with children, and I was very upset by certain scenes. And I look over at the children to see, are they as upset as I am? No. No, they're not.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the – I only know what I ended up doing. And I know that if I have somebody come in the store and I wait on them for children's books – I wouldn't sell them a dark ending book, but maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah. I remember Alice Walker writing a children's book about a little girl who's madly in love with her grandfather, and you see them together all through the book, and then you come to a point where this grandfather who's been sick in bed dies. And it is a beautiful book. She was, I think, wisely trying to talk to kids about if you've got a grandparent, some important relative, and you lose them. Well, I was practically hysterical. Crying. I just was so touched and upset. And I thought, well, in the end, this was a good thing. This was a good thing she did.
Well,
this feels
like jumping a little bit, but one of the things that, you know, we have a lot of parents that don't want their kids to read about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And in that case, I'm really unsympathetic. I'm like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Your kids are in school dealing with all of this. You think not letting them read a book about this is going to protect them. So I don't know.
Do you debate? Do they debate with you?
Yes.
Or do you?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're concerned their kids are going to become attracted to something that they're not otherwise attracted to.
Or numb to a certain level of things that are.
Yeah.
Yeah. This stuff is so hard. Really so hard. My hat's off to anyone who's a parent. As always, this show, thank you both so much. As always, this show is about the richness of life. And you can find the books, people, and recipes and wine and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.